So I've been a Christian for a long time. I know that there will be people in different spaces sitting in the room in front of me. But I think probably the most important question that one would need to answer if you are considering Christianity or if you are a Christian is who the person of Jesus actually is in terms of his identity. Who is this Jesus? And actually, I think it goes much further than that. I think this is a question that people will have to answer. Any person has to answer this question. Just by ignoring Jesus, you're giving a specific type of answer, I would argue. Because even Western history, at least, but the history of the largest part of the world is actually divided according to when this specific person lived, whatever you think of him. The year 2015 that we live in is a reference to him. Although it's now much more common to call it the common era and before the common era, BCE, etc. That's much more fashionable these days. But it's still a reference to when Jesus Christ lived and died. And the big question about Jesus, Marianne, if you could just go to the next one, please, is actually who he is. Okay, we need to figure out what is claimed about him. And I think if we get that wrong, and I will expand on that as we go through the talk, we're going to completely misunderstand Jesus, and if that is true, we're going to relate to him in a way that doesn't make sense and isn't necessarily even a good thing. Now, I'm going to have to focus my talk tonight on who Jesus is or claim to be or what the evidence tells us about who Jesus is. I'm not going to be able to spend time on a few other issues that are important, but that won't be the focus of my talk. It sounds like a bit of a, I don't know, is it okay? Well, I'm going to talk. You tell me if it's not audible. Okay, let's leave it at that. But I am not going to tonight try and defend the reliability of the New Testament, which I think is one of the foundational stones on which I'm going to build. I do think a very strong case is to be made and should be made at another time, but I'm going to not make that case for the reliability of the New Testament. But also, For the fact that the New Testament is reporting, or at least trying to report, whether they get it right or not, history. It's not an effort to create fiction. I've got one slide about that, but it's not an effort that somebody made to try and write a story. It is an effort that somebody made to try and write history down to the best of their ability. Whether they got everything right or wrong is a different question. Now, I am basing most of my talk on this book. It's called Putting Jesus in His Place. And it's one of those books where when you look at the author's names, you already find it difficult because it's written by Robert Bowman and J. Ed Kumuzewski. Okay, what a nice surname there at the bottom. Both of them, New Testament scholars, really interesting guys. I know Ed Kumuzewski at the moment has the health problems. Marianne, am I right? Okay, so he's actually struggling a lot with his health at the moment. But a really interesting book about making the case for the deity or the godness of Jesus Christ. And I think that's what I'm going to try and say a few things about tonight. Now, they start their book off with an interesting quote. This comes directly from their book. They say, "The Christian belief that Jesus Christ is God incarnate has been around so long that many people familiar with Christianity do not realize just how astonishing such a claim was and still is. Jesus was very much a real human being. He grew up in a dusty village as the son of a carpenter. He lived during the time of political turmoil for his people. He experienced the full range of human emotions, from unbridled joy to deep sorrow. He had friends and enemies. He perspired and got tired. He slept and awoke. He got hungry and thirsty. He bled and died. Indeed, by some measures, he was not a particularly remarkable man. He led no army, held no political office, wrote no books, had no wife or children, left no estate, and never traveled even 100 miles from his home. Yet, billions of people during the past 2 millennia over the world have worshipped him as their Lord and God. How in the world did this happen?" Okay. And to me, that sums it up beautifully. And what I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to challenge you, and as this book challenged me, and thinking about this issue challenged me quite a bit, I'm going to challenge you a bit tonight to also investigate your own presuppositions as we think about this issue. Because I often think, in the time in which we live, imperialism is something that people frown upon. So what is imperialism? It is saying everybody should be like me. But for us as postmodern or modern South Africans in this instance, brought up in a relatively Western type of style of education context, although it's in Africa. For us, we also look at the world and we look at history with very particular glasses on. We've been taught certain things, and we've taken it in with mother's milk, and it's become so familiar to us that it seems obvious, I would say. Okay, so when we look at certain things in the Bible and certain claims that are made, we often tend to look with what G.K. Chesterton called chronological snobbery. We look at that and we think, how could anybody think that or believe that, etc. And when we also look in the Bible for certain claims, for example, if you didn't know, there is no verse in the Bible where Jesus says, I am God. It's not there. Okay? But Christians for 2,000 years have claimed that Jesus is God. Now, how can we claim that Jesus is God, or at least claim to be God? Whether he was God is probably a slightly different matter. But how can we claim that Jesus claimed to be God if it doesn't say the words, I am God, anywhere in the New Testament? It sounds to our Western ears as if that is quite an unbelievable thing to claim. And it sounds like it's actually, you know, how are you going to defend that? You're going to have to make a very shaky little case to try and defend it. And I want to say tonight, I think that is not true. I think we can and we should be able to make a very, very strong case for the deity and the claims of Jesus Christ to be God. And I want to focus quite a bit of my time on those claims tonight. So what are the popular answers people give these days? If I were to ask them, who is Jesus? Most people in South Africa have heard of Jesus at least. And if I were to ask them, who is Jesus? Who was Jesus? Then some of the popular answers you will see in the press or that you'll hear when you speak to people is that he was a good person. Or other people will even claim that he never really existed. There was never really such a person as Jesus Christ. He's a fiction. Or others will claim he was a Jewish rabbi, probably a mystic of some sort who made some interesting claims. Or others will claim we could know almost nothing about the real Jesus. We don't really know who he was or whether he really existed. Or a variety of other claims. I mean, you can, especially if you read the Afrikaans newspaper Bild, you can get, in 1 year, you can get a real interesting variety of claims that people make about Jesus in that newspaper. I don't think the others really spend time on Jesus himself anymore. But there's this wide range of different opinions people hold about Jesus. But the one thing that you should not say in our culture, or that is at least very unpopular to say in our culture, is that Jesus is God. That is really not something that people will say very easily. So let's just see if the video clip works on the next one, where they asked a few people what they thought about Jesus. This is an American clip, but I think it would work in South Africa too. So let's see if it plays, please, Marianne. Sorry, Marianne, just check the sound of the computer, please.
Jesus, I would say no doubt lived as a person, but to the extent of what he did, I'm not sure.
If he comes walking into where I work, shows me the signs of the stigmata and tells me he's the son of God, I might start believing.
I don't believe in God, first of all. Maybe because I grew up in like an age of science.
I have a lot of different thoughts and theories on Jesus, but I don't think coming back from the dead is really, really possible.
Guy. So let's just stop right there. So a group of random people, they probably approached on the street and they asked them, who is Jesus? And they got this range of answers from, I don't really believe in God. She linked that to God immediately. And I don't really believe in God because she linked Jesus to faith of some sorts, at least. And she wouldn't believe in him. And a variety of other answers. But it's very difficult to claim that Jesus is God in the time in which we live. Now, the one thing I do want to say is, the New Testament documents, as we have them, especially the four Gospels and Acts, I want to claim quite strongly tonight that they at least try to report history. And we should trust them. I think we can make a strong case, as I said earlier, that we can trust them as historical documents. Now, many people will say that they are myths. Many people will say that they are fictions even these days. And here, C.S. Lewis was very helpful to me, who was a literary scholar. He's an English scholar. He studied myths in the original languages. He really understood myths. And he came up with the following quote. He said, "Either this is reportage, pretty close to the facts, or else some unknown writer in the second century, without known predecessors or successors, suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic realistic narrative. So what Lewis says as a literary scholar, and I think it's a really interesting point, is that the only time you get stories written in the way that the Gospels and Acts are written in about 1600-1700 is when the first of these stories are written in this style. Before that, none of these stories exist at all that are written in that style. There are myths and a variety of other types of writing. But only really from Shakespeare's time do you get stories written as realistic fiction, a narrative trying to tell somebody's story. And Lewis says, I have read all of these ancient documents, and I have not seen anything like the four Gospels. And that tells me that they are completely different from these other types of writings. These people saw something, and they were trying to report what they saw. Okay, so that's an arguable point, I know, and we could probably spend some time on that. Next one, please, Marianne. Now, what I want to start off with, before I make my actual argument for the deity of Christ, is I want to talk a little bit about what one should expect if you're going to look for arguments for the deity or the godness of Christ in the New Testament. If I wanted to communicate that I were God in this context, except for the fact that you would probably lock me up, if I wanted to communicate that, I would have to think about who you all are, what your presuppositions probably are, what you already know, and I would have to try and build on that if I were going to claim that I am God in a way that you would understand me. Now, in the time that Jesus lived, the context in which he lived, the Jewish nation to which he appeared, as you heard in that quote, he never traveled more than 100 miles. So let's make it 150 kilometers. So the radius within which Jesus lived is probably 150 kilometer radius within which he lived. That was the whole space within which he moved. He did meet with some people who were not Jews, the Samaritans mostly, and a few others. But the vast majority of Jesus' ministry was towards Jews. Okay. Now, if I wanted to speak to a Jew, I would firstly have to know that according to the Jews, God has a name that cannot be expressed. It may not. It is too holy. It cannot be expressed. Okay? As a matter of fact, the Jews don't know how to express the name of God written in the Bible because it's never expressed. Okay? It is called the ineffable, the unexpressible name of God. No Jew would walk around and say God's name, use God's name as a word. It just doesn't happen, okay? As a matter of fact, large parts of what gets translated in the Old Testament, the word Lord gets used because the word is too holy to actually use. So when Jesus goes to the Jews and he wants to tell them that he is God, it would have made absolutely no sense because what would he have said in terms of I am God? What word would he have used? There is no expression that Jesus could have used for them to actually hear the words, I am God. If Jesus were living today, I think it would be very likely that he would say the word, I am God. The Jews were, at that stage, probably the only really monotheistic nation on earth. Almost all other nations had many gods, okay? And most of them had names. They were not referred to as God. They were Baal or whatever they were called. They had these hundreds of different gods. And every town had their own god. And there were hundreds of different gods all around. The Jews were the only nation on earth that I'm aware of, and I might be corrected on this one, but at that stage, who were complete monotheists. They only thought of one God. There was no space for confusion with the Jews about who God was. They didn't think each city had their own God. They didn't think each season had its own God. They didn't think of hundreds of gods. The Jews thought of one God, and that God's name was inexpressible. You could not express it. It was too holy, and you could not use it. And that was the context within which Jesus came to minister. This is the context in which he came to make certain claims. And if we are going to understand what Jesus said, we have to be able to take off our own social cultural glasses, at least in part, at least put them at the front tip of your nose so you can at least peek over the top of your own glasses so that you can hear what Jesus is claiming very clearly. The question is, how did the people who lived with him, who listened to him, who understood that context, what did they understand him to say? How would he have revealed himself to this group of people in this time period so that they could understand? That is where we have to start if we're going to ask if Jesus claims to be God. Next one, please, Marianne. Now, Is it important that you get someone's identity right? Does it really matter? I'm going to use two stories, the one a true story and the one a complete fiction, to describe to you that I think it does make a difference if we get people's identities wrong. A friend of Marianne's went to a wedding, and she was seated next to a humongous guy who was sitting next to her. She didn't recognize him at all. She didn't know him, so she introduced herself. I don't know what her name is, so I can't even embarrass her. She said, "My name is whatever." He said, "Hi, my name is John." I said, "Hi, John, what do you do?" "No, I play rugby," he says. "Oh, that's interesting. Who do you play for? You know, do you play provincial?" "No, I'm actually the Springbok captain. You know, I'm John Smith." And apparently handled it with real grace, by the way. So apparently handled it really well. But the interesting thing is, she got his identity completely wrong, or she didn't have a clue what his identity was, and it made it really difficult for her. Not that she did anything wrong, but clearly she didn't have any context, and she misunderstood him. The second story actually works best in Afrikaans, but I'll tell it in English. It's a story of prior to 1994, when conscription was still part of people's lives, and they had to go to the army. Now, the most feared thing in the army was a corporal. A corporal was often 17 years old, and it doesn't matter who you were, the corporal had all the power in the world to make your life absolute hell. Okay, so the corporal would chase, during basic training, the corporal would be chasing people around, and you would be standing in rows. I didn't go to the army, but I've heard all of these stories. And you'd be standing in a row, and then you would wait, and then you would run to the next thing, and he would say, "Do you see that tree on that hill over there? I want the leaf." And then you would run and get the leaf, and then he'd come back and say, "Not that leaf, the one next to it." And you had to go back, you know. The corporals made people's lives really hell. And they were basically the soldier's life. So the story is told of this little troop who came in. He was during the first 1 or 2 months of his time, and he had just gotten a bit of a break from the corporal. The corporal had been chasing him all over the place, and he was leaning against a tree just to catch a bit of his breath. And the next moment, a colonel, which is quite a few ranks higher, if you didn't know, much more important person, came walking out in his dress clothes, which means he was dressed very fancily with white cuffs and a very nice with different color scheme. He looked really fancy. He came walking out of the barracks. And this troop was leaning against a tree. And the corporal went to stand in front of this troop, and he looked him up and down, and he said, "Troop, aren't you going to salute me?" And the troop just looked at him and said, "Hey, listen, our corporal's been chasing us around the whole day. Don't you guys from the post office come and give me grief too, okay?" Now, I can tell you, the fact that he got that guy's identity wrong changed his life, okay? Right. My point is to say that if we get somebody's identity wrong, we're going to relate to them in an inappropriate way, most probably, okay? So, if you've heard of this Jesus, which all of you would have, and you are then you're already relating to him in a certain way. The question is, how are you relating to him? And I would argue tonight, quite strongly, that whether he works for the post office or he's a colonel in the army makes a massive difference in how you're going to relate to him. Okay? So who is Jesus in your eyes at the moment? What is his identity? We're going to play a bit of a game quickly. Marianne, next one, please. So let's sign me into Facebook. Those of you who know me well will know I'm not on Facebook ever. Okay? But here we go. Signing me into Facebook quickly. And I've created a game for us tonight to figure out who Jesus is. Okay, so please go into the game for us, Marianne. Okay, there we go. We're into the game. So the game is going to work as follows. I wanted to still buy 2 chocolates today, but I didn't have time. So I'm sorry. No chocolates on offer. I would have loved to have some on offer. Okay, so the game is going to work as follows. Ah, we've got one, but we'll use it for the second one. Thank you very much, Lorraine. So we've got a chocolate on offer. If we don't get it one, this first one is just an example. Okay, it's easy. It's like those multiple choice questions. Are you whatever, you know, a boy or a girl? And you click girl to practice how to do it. This is one of those. Okay. So here we go. So what we're gonna do is, I've got somebody's identity hidden behind all of these question marks over there. I am going to give you some clues about the person, and then after that I'm even gonna give you a picture of the person. And then I want to see if you can guess who the person is, right? So the clues I'm going to give you is I'll give you some of the honor. Ooh, I spelled incorrectly here. I'm sorry. Okay. The honor the person has received. So what honors has this person received? The second thing I want to show you is some of the deeds, some of the things the person has actually done. Then I'm going to show you some of the attributes of the person. And then I'm going to show you some of the names that have been assigned to this person. And then lastly, I'll tell you some important positions that this person has been given. And I want you to use these clues to see if you can figure out who the person is I'm trying to get you to guess. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? So let's get the clues up, please, Marianne. Okay, so here are the clues. This person is the captain of the South African one-day international cricket team. He's the best batsman in the world. He has records for the most tests without a duck. Duck means getting null, by the way, if you didn't know. He had 78 tests in a row without a duck. He was the ICC International Cricketer of the Year in 2009. Some of the things that he's done, he holds the world record for the fastest 50 runs in 16 balls, the fastest 100 in 31 balls, and the fastest 150 in 64 balls. He had a 149 score of 44 balls. He just didn't get the 150. Otherwise, that would have been 45 balls. Okay? Some of his attributes. He looks like a surfer. He's got blue eyes and brown hair, which is often colored blonde. He's 1.78 meters tall. He has names like Benjamin, Abram, Abbas, AB, Mr. 360 Degrees, and Superman. And the position he holds is the national South African and international hero in his chosen sport. He's a real hero to many people. Okay, so don't tell me who it is yet. Let me just see by show of hands who are we talking about. Just see who knows. Okay, more than half of the room. Give us the picture, please, Marianne. There he is. Okay, who doesn't know yet? Oh, I won't embarrass you. So who wants to tell us? Who's that? Thank you. I thought you was going to say John Smith, but luckily he said A.B. de Villiers. Thanks, Yaku. Okay. Right, so that's A.B. de Villiers. I gave you the clues. You figured it out. So here is another important person. For this one, the chocolate is on offer. There might be somebody who gets this one, so let's see if you get it. It was easy, the first one. So here is the second one. Let's give you some details. This person was the most valuable player in his chosen sport for three different years. He's one of People magazine's 50 most attractive people. He's Associated Press Male Athlete of the Year for 2007. Some of the things he's done, he's led his team to the 2010 World Championships in his chosen sport, the second one in 3 years. He's 1.93 meters tall. He was born on the 3rd of August, 1977. He has brown hair and he weighs 102 kgs. Names for him, California Cool, Tom Terrific. Those are some of his nicknames. His position, he sat next to Mrs. Bush at the State of the Nation speech in America. That's how important he was. Mr. Bush was the president. He sat on the other side of her. Okay? That's how important he is. So, let's just see quickly, without saying, who knows who this is yet? No? Okay, luckily we've got them thus far. I wasn't sure. So, Marianne, next one, please. Let's show them a picture. Let's make their lives a lot easier. For the chocolate. Come on. I've shown you a lot of clues. I've actually gotten the chocolate. Yes, who is it? Well done. Okay? I won't hold you to Tom Brady Jr. I'll just give you for Tom Brady. I owe you a chocolate, Lorraine. Thank you very much for that. Okay. So, next one, please, Marianne. Why was this so much more difficult? Why did almost none of you know who Tom Brady was? I mean, he's a really important guy. If I did this to the Americans, would they have known who AB was? If I did this for an American audience and I asked them that first question, I would have swapped them around. Do you agree? I don't think any Americans would even have a clue who A.B. de Villiers is. They wouldn't have the faintest idea. I would have given them wonderful clues, but they would have missed it completely. What is my point? My point is to say it's really important to recognize the fact that the group you belong to, the time within which you live, the context with which you live, it's going to determine how you identify someone else when you get certain clues about that person. And if we want to go back to figure out who Jesus was, we will have to go back to the time in which he lived, the people who knew him best, the people who knew most about him, and see how they interpreted the data, what they thought about who Jesus is. Was he only a man, or was he more than a man, and was he, as many people have claimed over time, God himself? So, who are we going to look at? We're going to see what Jesus said about himself. Then we're going to also have a look at what Jesus' friends said about him. But very important, some people's friends only help us so far. It's also important to ask their enemies. We're going to ask his enemies too. We'll ask them what they thought about him. And then we'll see if we can see anything that God said about this Jesus character, if he said anything about who Jesus was. Now, I think it's really important to say that the God of the Bible, as the Jews know him and as they explain him to us, does not take anybody to be his equal. As a matter of fact, he gets described as a jealous God in the Bible. I think it's really important to know that for a Jew to take another God was a capital offense. You should get killed for that. That's what Jews thought about it. Okay? So I think it's really important to start off by saying to ourselves, the claims Jesus is going to make, the way his friends and enemies are going to react, will be crucial clues to tell us who he thought he was and what the people around him thought about who he was. And that's where we're going to have to start if we want to get a good idea of who Jesus was. So, the question I think we should consider tonight is, what would you think if the following things were said about a mere human being? Now, what we're going to say here in the argument, and you will see it as we go along, and we'll move into the actual evidence in a minute. But the actual argument here is to say that there are certain attributes, certain honors, certain names, and certain positions that, according to the Bible, is only ascribable to God himself. Nobody shares these with him. Okay? If you have that name or that position or that honor, you should not give it to anybody except to God. That is what the Bible teaches. That is what Jews thought. That is what happened in Jewish culture. Okay? So what we're going to see is I'm going to show you how claims made about the God of the Old Testament are repeated in the New Testament, but this time about Jesus. How these five different types of evidence are used in the Old Testament and then in the New Testament. Now, there's a huge amount more than what I'm going to be able to share with you tonight, just so that you know. In this book, for example, if I just look at the different honors, there's 9 different honors, where they give you the verses in the Old Testament and the verses in the New Testament, where it's ascribed to God, as in God the Father, as in the J-H-W-E, okay, that we're not sure how to pronounce, or on the other side, and on the other side, where these same honors in this instance are ascribed to Jesus. So I've selected a few because I don't have time to show you all of them tonight, because then we're only going to get out of here by 10, which I definitely won't do. So let's have a look at the honor, deeds, attributes, names, and position that were ascribed to Jesus Christ in the New Testament. Okay? And let's see what they give us. So, let's see what the radical claims about Jesus are. Now, the first radical claim about Jesus is that according to the Bible, according to the Old Testament, according to all Jewish customs, the only thing / person you worship is God. You don't worship anybody else. We have quite a few instances where an angel of the Lord appears to someone in the Bible and where somebody falls in worship in front of that angel because they're really impressed by the angel. Even in the book of Revelation, we see that John sees this angel and he falls in front of the angel to start worshiping the angel. And the first thing the angel does is say, "Stop, whoa, hey, don't do that. Please get up. I'm a creature like you. No worshiping here, thank you." Because the Jewish nation and the Bible teaches us very clearly the only person who should be worshipped is God. Nobody else gets worship. A Jew would not worship anybody else, and no Jew would accept anybody to worship them. I recently read through Acts, and I think it's Paul and Silas who go to this place where they heal somebody. And the people think they're some sort of a god, and they want to start worshipping them. And Paul just puts on the brakes and says, "Hold on for a second. No, 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 no. We aren't gods of any sorts. It does not fit a Jew to accept worship or to give worship to anybody else other than God." So we get in Deuteronomy 6:13 that instruction that only God should be worshipped. But then we get a few in the New Testament. I've only taken out one. In Matthew 28:9b, they came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. And the hymn that has been spoken thereof is Jesus. People in the New Testament, Thomas included at a later stage, worshipped Jesus. In the 40 days between his resurrection and his ascension, the people who met him often worshipped him. And Jesus did not stop them. He did not castigate them. As a matter of fact, he encouraged them. This is now after his resurrection. People did not worship Jesus before his crucifixion, of course. Okay? But they worshipped him after his resurrection. Next one, please. Let's look at some other honors. Prayer is always addressed to God. We see that in Psalm 65:3. And then, this is just one example of the Old Testament, where prayer is addressed to God, right? Let's look at the New Testament, and I find this fascinating. Because people will also tell you, oh yes, Jesus became God at the Council of Nicaea, where it was a close call, to quote Dan Brown, and they just voted him in as God, right? I mean, you know nothing of history if you say that, I'm sorry to say, because it's just not, none of that actually fits into the facts. But if we go really early in Acts 1, verse 24 to 25, a new apostle needs to be chosen because Judas Iscariot had killed himself. So they need a 12th person to fill up the number. Guess what happens in Acts 1, verse 24 and 25? They pray to Jesus. What? Excuse me? These same people who ran away, one of them ran away so quickly that he ran out of his clothes, these same people are now praying to Jesus Christ in Acts 1, 24 to 25. They were Jews. They would only pray to God. But in this instance, they are praying to Jesus. And then, very interesting, in Acts 7, 59 and 60, we have the stoning of Stephen. When Jesus hangs on the cross, what does he say? Father, into your hands, I'm not sure what the right word is there, my spirit. I commit my spirit. I give you a guess what Stephen prays when he gets killed. Guess who he prays to? Guess to whom he commits his spirit? Jesus. Okay? So, not only worship, but also prayer gets addressed to Jesus, which should only be given, according to all Jewish custom, to God the Father. They sang songs. We know about all the songs, the longest book in the Bible, the longest chapter in the Bible, all of them are songs. Okay? So, the Psalms are filled with songs. Exodus 15:21, singing to God. And in Ephesians 5, verse 18 and 20, we find that the church are singing songs now to Jesus Christ, which should only be addressed to God, now gets addressed to Jesus Christ. And they get encouraged to put their faith in the leaning of the entire human personality, the leaning of the entire human person, as Colossians explains it, especially if you look at the Amplified. So to put your faith in is to put your trust in, to put your weight on. Now you should only, according to Jewish custom and all Jewish religious knowledge, put your faith in God. That's the only one. You should not put it in man. You should not put it in anything else, any other God, just God, God of the Bible. But then we find in Galatians 3:26, when there Paul is writing to Jews, by the way. Galatians is a book aimed very much at the Jews. And it tells them to put their faith in whom? Jesus. Okay? Right, once again, one of Paul's early books, Galatians. So very early on, we get the church doing things, offering things to Jesus, which should only be offered to God. And then the fear of the Lord, the whole idea of not trembling in your boots fear, that whole fear that a little child has of a father, that type of fear, the good fear, where C.S. Lewis, where is it Lucy who meets Aslan and then asks the beaver, so is he a tame lion? And the beaver starts laughing and says, don't be ridiculous, he's not a tame lion, but he's a good lion. That's the fear of the Lord, okay? Right? To be meet up with a lion who's a real wild lion, but he's a good lion, right? That fear in 2 Corinthians 5:10 gets attributed to Jesus as well, which should only be attributed to God. Next one, please, Marianne. So let's move on. There are quite a few more honors we could look at, but I'm going to run out of time if I'm not careful. So let's look at what the Bible tells us God does. And let's see what the Bible tells us Jesus does. Okay? So, God is the creator. Isaiah 37 verse 16 tells us that, and Genesis 1 tells us that God is the creator of everything. And in John 1 verse 3, we read that everything was created by and through Jesus. Jesus is the creator. That we are get taught in John 1. Okay? He rules over the forces of nature. We find the Israelites going out of Egypt and God splits the sea and then they walk through the sea on dry feet, we are told.
God has power over nature. Now, some people will tell you, no, they have the wrong sea. The sea is actually only that thick, that deep, so that it was easy for them. But then you have to explain how he drowned all of the Egyptians in that much water. I don't know how you're going to do that. Okay, all right? Okay, and in Mark 4, verse 35 to 41, we find Jesus sleeping on a boat. Massive storm comes up. They're all very afraid. He stands up and rebukes the storm like you would rebuke your dog. No, stop it. We don't know exactly what he said. Sit down. Storm gone. Right? So we find exactly the same thing. Jesus rules over the forces of nature. This storm, which can make really experienced fishermen fear for their lives, he stands up and he quietens it down with one word. Okay? He speaks with godly authority. Now, this is also, I find this one also, because it's slightly more nuanced. But in the Old Testament, 400 times we have, or over 400 times, we have the words, so says the Lord. In other words, so speaks God. These are the words of God. You better listen to them. And then we find in Matthew 5, which is the Sermon on the Mount, something really interesting. Where Jesus goes and he says, you have heard it said. You have heard it said that this thing is wrong. Okay, or that thing is wrong. You know that section? And then he does something really interesting. He continues that sentence by saying, but I say unto you. So what is he doing? He's taking God's words, because every time he says that, he's taking an instruction from God, something that God told them to do or not to do, and he's expanding on that by saying, but I say to you. Can you see what Jesus is doing by doing that? He's taking God's authority upon himself by taking God's own words and basically expanding on them and replacing them by saying, this is really the law. This is really what it means. Okay? And then the forgiveness of sins. Only God can forgive sins. You cannot forgive somebody. If I step on Yaku's toe and Inika says, I forgive you, Andre, it means nothing. How can Inika forgive me for stepping on Yaku's toe? I mean, we can try it, Yaku, if you like. No, thank you. He's fine, he says. Okay? Only the offended party can forgive. You can't forgive something that you were not offended for. That's ridiculous. It's meaningless. So we find in the Bible that all sin in the end is offense to God. That's what it is, in essence. It's offense to God. The only person who can forgive that sin is God himself. And still we find quite a few examples where people don't tell, where Jesus doesn't go and do the easy thing and tells a person, ach, stand up, you know, easy. He says to them, your sins are forgiven. Wow, that is incredible. In other words, Jesus says, your sin was an offense to me, and I am telling you, I forgive you. That is a massive claim to make, okay? Because it means you are claiming that all sin is actually against you. And that's what Jesus is claiming when he does that. And then the raising of the dead. God raises the dead in 1 Samuel 2 verse 6. And in John 6, 40, we get Jesus raising the dead. So Jesus doing quite a number of things. And this is a short list of the things that only God can do. Next one, please, Marianne. The attributes. Okay, so all the attributes of God. So let's start with all God's attributes. In John 12, 45, we are told that if you see the Son, you see the Father. And the implication of that is, if you want to see the Father, look at the Son. If you want to know who the Father is and what he's like, look at the Son. Because if you see the Father, you see the Son. And in Colossians 1 verse 19, we are told that the fullness of God, in other words, everything that makes God, God, dwelt in Jesus, is there within Jesus. Jesus claimed to exist before he was born. How is that for an interesting claim? I don't know if you've ever met anybody who claimed that. Maybe if they believe in reincarnation, they could have claimed something similar. But Jesus claims to have existed before he was born. Okay? Now, we're not going to, luckily for me, it's not my job to explain the whole concept of time. If you want to listen to that, get Bill Craig when he speaks on time. He'll confuse you completely. Oh, well, maybe he won't confuse you, but he confused me completely. Because, yeah, let me not even go there. All I want to tell you is that Jesus claims in Matthew 23, 37, and we see it again in John 8, verse 58, to have existed before he was born. Okay. In other words, Jesus claims to be eternal, to have been there forever. That's what he claims. Okay. And we see it again in John 1 verse 1, that the Bible claims, John claims, which is one of Jesus' friends, that it starts exactly the same as Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God, right? Go read John 1 verse 1 in your Bible tonight when you go to bed. It starts exactly the same as Genesis 1 verse 1. But it says, in the beginning, the Word. In the beginning, the Logos. Who is this Logos he speaks about? Just read the rest of the chapter and you'll soon find that he's talking of Jesus. From the beginning, when everything began, Jesus was there, according to the Bible and according to his own claims and those of his friends. Being almighty. In Job 42 verse 2, we get told God is almighty. And in Matthew 28:18, a similar claim is made for Jesus. Omnipresent, everywhere at the same time. Now, obviously not while he was in bodily form. I'm not claiming that Jesus walked in Israel and in South Africa while he was in bodily form. That's not what I'm claiming. But in Luke 7 verse 1 to 10, we get Jesus calling his disciples and knowing something where he wasn't present. Knowing something about one of the disciples, I can't remember which one he called, and then he said to him, yes, I saw you there under the tree and I know what you were doing and thinking. Okay, what? How do you know that? And then he actually starts following Jesus. Okay, so Jesus has the ability to know things where he was not physically present, even in his bodily form. Okay, next one please. Names. There is a term used for God. He has the name above all names. And if you understand the whole ineffability, the fact that the name of God cannot be expressed, you will understand why it's the name above all names. It is the name that is greater than all names. The words, the name above all names, gets ascribed to God. He has the name above all names. And exactly that same term gets used for Jesus in Matthew 24, verse 9b, that he has the name above all names. The term God in Deuteronomy 4 verse 35b, and we actually get it in Romans 9 verse 5b. Now, this is obviously after his resurrection written by Paul, okay, where it says that Jesus is God. It's the only place where it's written. Jesus didn't say it himself, but Paul did write that in Romans 9 verse 5b. When Moses goes out, after he had to run away from Egypt, he went to be a farmer for some time, and then he came to a burning bush. Where God, can I tell a joke quickly? Okay. you know there's a Bush in the race again, and then there's a Clinton. Who do you think the Israelis hope are going to win the election? Okay, they hope it's going to be the Clinton, because the last time their leader spoke to a Bush, they traveled in the desert for 40 years. Okay. Now, I'm kidding, of course, but in this instance, Moses came to this bush, and the God of Israel introduced himself to Moses, and Moses said to him, who am I going to tell them sent me? What is your name? And God introduces him as I am who I am. I am. And in the Gospel of John, we find the I am sayings of Jesus, quite a number of them, where Jesus claims the name of God, the I am name of God he claims to himself in the Gospel of John. The same words we get in Exodus 3:14, we get in John 4:26, where Jesus takes the I am name of God and claims it to himself. The word Lord versus the word Lord in capital letters. Now, when those letters are written, the YHWH, that is the ineffable, the inexpressible name of God, we find that the Jews will often replace that with the word Lord. Kurios, I think, is what's used in the New Testament for it. But in our Bibles, the difference between Lord, which just means manager or master, and the Lord in capital letters, the Lord in capital letters in your Bible always refers to the YHWH, the name of God. Okay? So there's two different Lords that you'll find in your Bible. The one will be written in caps, and the other one will be written like that. Okay? And the one refers to that word, and the other one basically refers to the word master. In Genesis 2 verse 4b, and in Matthew 14, verse 30, we get the tetragrammaton, as it's called, the name of God being used for God and for Jesus as well. And then the last of the names, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, once again, a beautiful name ascribed to God and also ascribed to Jesus in Revelation 17, verse 14. Okay, next one, please, Marianne. The position, which I think is the last one. Let me just check. Yeah, that's the last one. So hopefully you're still awake. We're almost done with those, and then just a few slides that I want to use to wrap it all up with. Okay, so let's just look at the position. God's highest throne. In other words, God has a throne that is above all the thrones. And in Daniel, we get the picture of God sitting on that throne. And in 1 Corinthians 15:25, Jesus sits on that throne. Okay? So Jesus gets put in the same position that we see in Daniel in 1 Corinthians. Jesus gets put in that same position. Claim to be equal to God. Now, nothing can be equal to God, according to the way Jews understood God and understand God even today. Nothing can be equal to God. But in Mark 14, verse 61 and 64, Jesus makes that claim to be equal to God. Okay? And then the second to last one, to reign over all things. In Jeremiah 10, 16, we are told God reigns over all things. And in Ephesians 1, 22, we are told Jesus reigns over all things. Once again, both of these, claims about God and claims about Jesus. And to reign forever. In Psalm 9, verse 7 to 8, we get told God will reign forever. And in Hebrews 1, verse 8, we get told Jesus will reign forever. Now, that was, as one of our American friends always says, like drinking from a fire hydrant. Okay, like drinking from a fire hose. I know, I just chucked a lot of verses. I'll make sure you get the PowerPoint if you want to have a look at some of those verses. Please go and look them up and think about them. And I would strongly advise you to read Putting Jesus in His Place. Okay, the next one, please. So, those were the ones we've just looked at. We looked at what Jesus said. He spoke in quite a few of those, if you're going to look them up. We looked at quite a few of his friends, but you'll see I chose the ones so that we could see different people's perspective on him. I didn't just choose John. I had John in there, Matthew was in there, Luke was in there, Paul was in there, Peter was in there. I chose all the people around Jesus. So if you're going to look at the verses I chose, if you're going to work through them, you'll find all the friends of Jesus saying the same thing about him. Okay? The Bible also gives us an interesting indication of what God thought. Now, this is a different topic because we will need to spend time on the resurrection, but please give it to us, Marianne. In Romans 1, verse 3 to 4, it says, regarding his son, who as to his human nature was a descendant of David, and who through the spirit of holiness was declared with power to be the son of God by his resurrection from the dead. So the resurrection of Jesus is the final confirmation of his identity. Okay? The resurrection of Jesus is the final declaration of his identity. So we've looked at what Jesus said about himself. We've looked at what his friends said about him. We've now just looked at one thing that God said about him according to the Bible. And then the last group we need to just quickly talk about is Jesus' enemies. How did the people react who did not like Jesus? How did the people react who were against him? Now, we find instances, and I did put verses to all of these, where the high priest tore his clothes when Jesus was witnessing in front of him, which was illegal for him to do. He wasn't allowed to do that. The only thing he could ever do that for was absolute blasphemy. Other people could tear their clothes. I don't know how you did it. You know, they always, if you look at the movies, they have these thick cloths on. I don't know how you're going to tear it. You need to be quite strong, I think. But the high priest tore his clothes at some of the claims that Jesus made, which was a sign that the high priest understood Jesus' claims as absolute blasphemy. In other words, claiming equality to God, that is absolute blasphemy. Okay. There are quite a few instances where people wanted to stone Jesus. Stoning is a capital offense. In other words, you must have done something that deserved you to die. And that wasn't a lawless time. You completely misunderstand the time. If you just stoned somebody to death, you would probably be killed if you didn't have really good reason to do it. These instances where the people wanted to kill or stone Jesus almost always were in instances where he claimed things which those people understood him to be claiming to be equal to God or to be God himself. Jesus was regularly persecuted during the 3 years of his ministry, and in the end, he was crucified. In the end, Jesus was killed for something. So what was he killed for? Why did the Jews insist on killing Jesus? And I think you can make a really strong case that even his crucifixion at least supports the claim that he claimed to be God. Whether it's true or not is a different story. But the people killed him because of the claims he was making. That's why he was killed. And then if you believe Acts, the opinion of demons. When demons speak in Acts, it's interesting what they say about Jesus. Okay, they are clearly his enemies, and they speak of him as being God and being the powerful one by whose name demons can be driven and are driven out. Why all of this fuss from his enemies? Why the tearing of clothes and the stonings and the stuff like that and in the crucifixion? Why this vociferous reaction to him from his enemies' sake? And I think you're going to have to give me a really good reason other than him claiming a claim such as being God. Next one, please, Marianne. Okay. So, I would argue tonight to say much more than I actually shared with you tonight, that there is a finely woven case for Jesus' identity. If I were able to put up a Facebook page game, a Facebook game for the Jews 2,000 years ago, and I gave them the claims that I gave you now just about Jesus, and I asked them, who are we talking about? They would have said Yahweh, or the inexpressible, the Lord. That's who you're talking about. The claims made about Jesus for any Jew would have directly pointed, the claims he made for himself and by his friends would have directly pointed for any Jew to the fact that Jesus was claiming to be equal to God. Okay, the Lord in capital letters. That was very clear. Next one, please, Marianne. So, I know I always do this when I come to Dialoog, so I don't mind to say that he's one of my heroes. So I always quote C.S. Lewis. I've already done it once tonight, but I'll have to do it again. And you've seen this quote before. If you've heard me speak at Dialoog before, you've seen this quote. But I just think it is so powerful, and few people could say things as beautifully as Lewis could say them. So let's look at what he said. So this was Lewis's opinion. You're confronted with Jesus, and you have to make a decision. And what Lewis says is the following. I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. This is Jesus he's speaking about. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. Let's just stop there for a second. You saw the things Jesus said about himself right now. He made these massive claims. And Lewis is saying, anybody who says stuff like that should be locked up in one of two places, either prison or the lunatic asylum. Okay? So Lewis goes on and he says, he would either be a lunatic on the level of a man who says that he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil from hell. You must make your choice about this Jesus. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come up with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He did not leave that open to us. He did not intend to. Okay? Beautifully said, as Lewis always does. My second last slide, actually my last one with content on. Actually, no, I'm lying. There's one more with content on. So, what Lewis is saying, to sum it up, is that as these things go, the claims Jesus made leave us with three basic, and you could probably expand that to a fourth, but let's leave that out for tonight. It gives us three choices. If you accept the historicity of the Bible and you accept the fact that these were actually the claims made by Jesus and his followers, you have three choices. The first choice is that Jesus and everybody who knew him best and everybody around him lied. That's the first choice you have. I think you're going to find that incredibly difficult to defend. Okay? And I think actually Jesus is probably the most honest person you'll ever encounter in your life if you read the Gospels. Was he crazy? And nobody else realized it. Nobody else realized this guy is just losing the plot completely. It was just him, and he was completely crazy. I've not read a psychological analysis of the Gospels which say that, and it would be really convenient if one could find clear signs of schizophrenia or whatever they would find in him. It would be really convenient. You could then shift him to the side. Okay? But I'm not aware of anybody making one of these two cases very strongly. The fact is, if it's not a lie, and if he wasn't crazy, and he was making these humongous claims as were his followers, then he might be, and he is, who he said he was, and that is actually God himself, incarnate in a human being, Jesus Christ. And to be honest, I know many people who ignore this Jesus. I know many people who put him to the periphery and just make him another character. But I think that's the one thing you cannot do with him. That's probably the biggest mistake you can make. And I'm sorry if I've done this before, but I think I need to use this illustration. In God, Jesus comes and makes an offer to all human beings by saying, here I am, incarnate. I have come to earth, lived the life you should have lived, died the death you should have died, and rose from the dead. And in the end, the only choices you have is to react to this Jesus. You have to react in some way. And the two basic choices you have is to either accept or reject him. Those are the two basic choices. But ignoring him is also rejection. When I asked Marianne to marry me on the stoop here in where is it, Marianne? What is the area called? Linwood, okay? We sat in her brother's flat on the top floor on the stoop, beautiful night. I did all the nice little things that I could do. I'm not the most natural romantic on earth. And I said, Marianne, will you marry me? Okay? And she basically had the same choice as we have with Jesus. That's exactly the same thing. If somebody ever comes to you and says, will you marry me? You basically only have two choices. You don't have a third. Okay? The first choice you have is to, her answer was at that point, what was it, Marianne? I always say, really, and the reason I'm asking her is because I want to get the words right. She said to me, are you sure? Okay, so now I could have taken that as a factual question and say, well, I'm still thinking, I'm at about 87.3% certain. No. Okay, let's say she asked me, are you sure? And I said, yes, I'm sure. And I actually did say, yes, I'm sure. But then I continued my question. I said, but what is your answer? Because if Marianne had said, are you sure? It's a beautiful night tonight, isn't it? Just look at those stars. Isn't Pretoria a lovely city at night? What does that actually mean? Oh, I would have been a goner, wouldn't I? Okay. She would have said no. She just wouldn't have had the guts to say no to my face. Okay. Now, in Jesus, God comes and makes an offer to all humanity. And you basically only have the two choices. The third one, you think you're doing something, but you're actually doing something completely different. Please, last slide, Marianne. So, I'm not sure. You know, I work at a university. I want to call you ladies and gentlemen. Do I call you brothers and sisters? What do I call you? Okay, all of you lot. Okay, all of you lot sitting here with me in the room. I'll just stick to that. You lot with me in the room. I really don't want to, I'm not going to do an altar call or anything like that, so you can relax. But I really want to just say, I think it's crucial that you realize the question Jesus asked his disciples is the question he's asking tonight, and he asks every person on earth. You know, he came to his disciples at one point, and he said to them, who do the people say I am? And they told him, oh, they said you're Elijah, and you're this one, you're that one. And then he said, oh, and you, who do you say I am? And then we get this amazing confession by Peter. But I think what one must realize is that this is actually, in the end, like getting married, a very personal question. Jesus made these claims, his disciples did. It's supported by a lot of evidence, I would argue. And if you can move your own postmodern, modern, Western, South African, we are such an interesting mix, glasses off your nose for a bit, you can't miss the fact that Jesus is claiming that. And the question is, what is your answer to this Jesus when he comes to you and offers himself to you? And I want to add to that and just say, what are the implications of this Jesus if he's really God? It's a scary thing if the lion isn't tame. He's good, but he's not tame. Because that lion might just interfere with your life. That lion might just have certain things to say to you and certain influences that he wants to push onto your life or come and make true in your life. That lion might want to be more than just a pet. He might want to be the ruler, because lions don't make good pets, okay? And if Jesus is really God, then you must know that making him your pet isn't going to work on the long term, because he'll make a horrible pet. He makes a wonderful master and a horrible pet. So, what for you personally would the implications be on your life if this Jesus were really God? What would that mean in terms of how you treat other people, how you treat yourself, how you think about the relationships you have to everything on earth? The whole idea of shalom, peace, not peace as in the absence of war, the peace of as something active and present, the state of complete happiness is such a frivolous word. Complete contentment is probably a better word. Because your relationships between yourself and yourself, yourself and other people, yourself and God, yourself and nature has been restored through this Jesus. What would the implications be if that were true? Okay, so that was the closest I got to an altar call, right? May I just pray for us before we go over to the questions? Okay, so let's just pray together.
Lord, thank you that we can come to you tonight with our minds and our hearts in different places, but that we can all come together as a group of people who are sitting here together tonight. Every person in this room is at a different spot in their journey. Different things are happening to them. Different thoughts are crossing their mind. They all have a story, Lord. Thank you, Jesus, that we can see in your word that you stop and you call Zacchaeus down from the tree and you spend time with him. And that you meet the woman at the well where she is. And that you meet your disciples where they are. Lord, thank you that you are the one who meets people where they are. And because of the places we go to, Lord, because of the things we do, because of the stories we have that lie behind us, because of the plans we have for our own future, a finite person would not be able to meet us where we need to be met. We would need somebody more than a person. We would need God himself to come and meet us. Lord Jesus, and the fact that the Bible tells us that God took off what it means to be God to a certain extent, in a certain way, which we don't really understand, and put himself in human form, came to enter our broken world, came to feel the things we feel, to have the challenges we have. Lord, thank you that you came to do that and that you died the death we should have died and lived the life we should have lived so that we may be reconciled to you. I just want to pray for everybody in this room, wherever they are, whatever their thoughts are, that you'll be with them and busy with them and with me too. I pray all of this in the name that is above all names, the name of Jesus, the Christ and our Savior. Amen. Right.
Thank you, Andre. Now we are at the dialog part, so you can just put up here, and if you have a question for the speaker, I will bring you the microphone, and you can ask your question.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Okay.
During the 19th and 20th century, various restoration and holiness movements started to assert the names to God, Yahweh and El Shaddai. Where do these come from when God is supposed to be nameless?
Sorry, I just want to make sure I get your question perfectly sorted. So I'm going to try and repeat it, and then you tell me if I'm getting it right. Okay? So you're saying there are these holiness movements, as you call them, that started calling themselves like the Jehovah's this or the this church. Or are you talking of those?
They asserted those names to God.
Okay. So they actually use those names for God. Now, I just want to say, I think, as far as I know, and I stand to be corrected on this, I don't think God says that we're not allowed to give him a name. I think the name that God gives Moses is the name, when Moses asks him, it's the only instance in the history of the human race where anybody asks God, so what's your name? And he says, I am who I am. That's the name he uses for himself. I don't think there's any harm, real harm, in taking those four letters and trying to find a pronunciation for it. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with that. Because I think in Jesus, God comes and introduces himself to us with a name. He actually would have been called Yeshua ben Joseph, and I can't even say the Jewishness, you know. So God actually comes and takes on a name in that sense, in Jesus. So I'm not sure that I'm answering your question. I would just say that it's a human habit. People are trying to find a name for it, and they're trying to pronounce it. And they're trying to, obviously, I don't think most of them would have had bad intentions, but they're trying to show that they're closer to God in a certain sense. They want to be more serious about him, and therefore they take on his name that they think is the way it should be pronounced.
Thank you, Peter.
I once had a conversation with an agnostic guy who I think has a very solid way of thinking.
Yes.
And I posed the same case to him. I said, okay, so we've got Jesus. We agree that the guy existed, right? So, and, well, you said all of these things. I basically made a similar case to what you did. And I asked him, so, you know, where are you now really? Do you believe that God is, or that Jesus was a madman, was he a liar, or was he actually God?
Yep.
And then what the guy said was, you know, I don't think he was one of those things. I actually think that what was written about him in the Bible is not really all that accurate. I think that people afterwards said he said things which he didn't say and things like that. Now, I know that at the start you said that the reliability of the New Testament is sort of out of the scope of your talk. But just, I'd like to ask you, For example, I read a part of The Case for Christ where they said that 11 of the 12 disciples was martyred because of their beliefs, which in my opinion makes a pretty strong case for the veracity thereof. But, I mean, how do people know that 11 of the 12 disciples died? The source that tells us that, is it reliable? Hmm. Just a bit about, like, how do we even know all of this stuff is true?
All right, thank you. So I'm going to separate the two issues. I'm not going to talk about the disciples as much because I think there we have much weaker evidence, funnily enough. So if we see how 10 of the 11, you could say 11 of the 12, that's fine, but two. It's only John, basically, wasn't martyred for his faith. John died of old age, we think, in Ephesus. Now, he was persecuted, but he wasn't martyred. Okay. So I also think that's quite strong evidence for the resurrection, at least. I think I'll say two things about... there's so much to say. One actually needs a lot more time. But let me firstly say this. I think even critical scholars who don't believe Jesus was God will agree that we have the New Testament as it was written close to 99.5%. Okay, so the Greek and other language texts we use to translate the Bible from now is a standard text that is used across the world by all translators. It's the same text. We've got more than 99% certainty. We've got the text as it was written. So the argument you're going to have to make, I think, if you're going to be reasonable about this, is that the people who wrote it either lied or made it up. That's the argument you're going to have to make. Okay. Now, there I would just say, you have absolute. It's an argument from silence. There is absolutely no evidence. And as a matter of fact, I think if you're going to argue, I would want to see his argument. I would want to say, okay, right, you're making a factual claim. The New Testament isn't reliable. Based on what? Because ancient texts, if you study ancient texts, your starting point is always to say that I believe them unless proven otherwise. That's a funny way to do it, but that's the way it's done. Because you have so few ancient texts and so few copies of it. So we tend to take them on their word, except when we work with the Bible, funnily enough. Okay, so I would want to ask the person, based on what? So if we were going to take an argumentative route on this. But my experience with agnostics, and I know there will be a few of you in the room, is that you get a number of types of agnostics. The one agnostic is a person who's really busy with a journey trying to figure out what he or she believes. Okay? But they're busy moving. In other words, sometimes they're moving closer to God, and other times they're moving closer, further away from believing in God. But they're moving all the time because they're willing to follow the evidence where it leads. But then I've met quite a few, actually, of types of agnostics who are much more like a bar of soap. If you press one piece, they jump in another direction. And then if you press there, they jump in another direction. If they press there... And those agnostics don't want to invest any of their personhood into this. They don't want it to be true. As somebody once said, if reasons don't convince you, then reason isn't the problem. Okay? Then something else is the problem. And I can't say about this friend of yours, but what I would ask somebody like that is, what would convince you? So please tell me, what would convince you? So let's not follow the argument. But is there anything I can put on the table that would convince you that Jesus is God? And if nothing could convince you, hey, great, let's be friends and talk about a lot of stuff, but what am I supposed to bring? I can't bring anything because you don't want to be convinced. Okay, so those are just a few thoughts, and they were not very well organized. So I hope you got something from that.
Maybe one last question. Okay, two last questions.
Hi, my name is Linda.
Hello, Linda.
You touched on a point... which you said that Jesus existed before.
Yes.
And I read something in the Bible that's always worried me, and I would like your take on it, about Melchizedek.
Yeah.
It also says in Genesis and Hebrews that he pre-existed, and he was without father and without mother. So how would you explain?
Where exactly, what verses are you referring to?
Genesis 14:18, they talk about the king of Salem, Melchizedek.
Yes. Yes.
God's high priest.
Okay, but, yeah, okay. I know exactly what that says,
And then in Hebrews 7, verse 3.
Yes.
it also refers to Melchizedek.
I know about Melchizedek, and Melchizedek. I don't know how to pronounce his name in English. I don't even know how to pronounce it in Afrikaans, to be honest. But look, I know a lot about Melchizedek. I don't know about him not being born and stuff like that. I mean, the Bible doesn't claim that directly. If you look,
Psalms 110 verse 6 says, he was without father, without mother.
Psalm 110, 6.
110, 6.
Okay, let's just go there. I've actually never heard this before.
Having neither beginning of days nor end of life.
But, but it doesn't speak directly of Melchizedek. It just speaks of a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek.
If you read it in context, you'll see that they will speak of Melchizedek.
Just say the verse again about not being born.
He's without father, without mother, without genealogy.
Which verse is that?
Neither a beginning of days. It's 6.
Verse 6. Okay, you see, I've got the New International Version. They actually translate that verse completely differently. So what I would want to do is, if you don't mind, because I don't think this is a forum we're going to solve this. Marianne, there's my email address. Would you mind if we have this discussion over email? I just think this is the type of thing that's going to need a bit more time. I'd love to talk to you, so please email me that one, okay? If people don't mind, I just think it makes more sense. I'd love to look at the scriptures, and then we can talk about those. Hello, Valdi.
Muslims and Jews also refer to Bible verses to support their view, because there are some Bible verses suggesting a Unitarian view of God. So,
yes.
What do we do with those verses?
I just want to make sure I get the gist of your question. So, is your question why the Trinity, not Unitarianism, or is your question? I want to understand what you want me to.
How can Muslims and Jews even make a case for their view?
Okay. Look, Jews use the Old Testament, and the only references to God being a Trinity, as Christians understand him, to be revealed, are a few places, like in Genesis 1, where you get the reference to the hour, the more than one, okay? But if you only accept the Old Testament, I don't think you're going to really make a case for a Trinity. I don't think you can really make a case for anything more than God being one, Unitarian, as you call it, okay? So for the Jews, I don't think it's something strange. For the Muslims use the Old Testament and the Quran, but they don't really use the New Testament when it comes to that. They don't really accept that as a scripture. The Quran is written about Jesus. There are a few things written about Jesus 600 years after he lived, and claimed to be, and I mean, that's one we'd have to spend time on. I don't want to just brush it aside. I think one would need to spend time on it. But you must understand the claims I'm talking about tonight were made within one generation by eyewitnesses of people who lived in the same generation as Jesus, to Jews who lived in that context, in the historical context where it could be tested. The claims Muhammad is making about Jesus and God in terms of Jesus is made 600 years later in Arabia, where there are no Jews really, maybe one or two, in a completely different cultural context where it's impossible to test. Now, I'm not therefore saying Muhammad is definitely wrong, we need to chuck him out. I'm just saying I don't find the two in direct competition, because to me, either the New Testament is right or the Quran. Let's be completely straight about that. The Old Testament is not problematic, because in the Old Testament, we get revelation of God growing over time, developing. And what the New Testament is claiming is that that developmental process continues into the New Testament and finds its final revelation in Jesus and his teachings. Okay, so the New Testament is not claiming to be disjunct from the Old Testament. It's claiming to be a continuation of the Old Testament, whereas the Quran is not. The Quran is something different, and I would want to treat that differently. I personally think the textual and evidential basis of the New Testament, this is a personal view, and I would need a lot of time, is hugely, like in massively much stronger for the New Testament than it is for the Quran, when it comes to claims about Jesus especially. Okay, but we would need time to discuss that. Okay, so I hope I'm answering your question.
Thank you, Andre. Just on that note, I realize I was a terrible presenter beforehand, just to say who you are and so forth. Andre is a veteran, a seasoned apologist, and he's part of the antwoord.org.za.
Yeah, we bring out albums and we sing.
A website where they actually talk about all these questions, and you can mail questions, and he put his personal email on there, and they really make an effort to answer some very difficult questions. So, André, baie dankie dat jy vanaand hier was. Let's give him a hand, guys.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So we've got coffee, we've got tea, we've got the book table. The dialogue can continue from now. Dankie dat jy hier was. Ons sien weer volgende week.